Welcome to the first episode of Let's Do Launch on Classic Gaming Quarterly Radio. I'm your host, Chris Alamo, and I'm joined by my co-host and good buddy, Anthony Norsha, as we discuss the launches of various classic gaming consoles. Today we're doing what console?
The Sega Genesis.
Awesome. But before we get started, let's take the opportunity to introduce ourselves. Anthony, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, okay, my name's Anthony, and first, I want to say I am a bit of an older gamer, 43. One cool thing about being older like I am is that, like, I've kind of grown up with video games from, you know, the beginning. Like, as I've gotten older, video games have gotten older. You know, I mean, I started with the Atari 2600 and, you know, just all the way through. And it's kind of a cool perspective because it's like, you know, it's like somebody that grew up with, like, silent films and, you know, like when they were super little and they saw it all the way to color and talkies and blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of like I'm growing up with this entire, you know, medium. And it just happened to have coincided with, like, my age group, you know, because I was 7 years old when the 2600 was released. And
did you have one?
Yeah, we did. I believe that we did have one Christmas of 77 because we started off with Combat and then, you know, slowly but surely games started trickling out. So I'm pretty sure it was the very beginning.
And, but so you've basically had at least one console from like every of the major generations then.
Yeah. And, you know, one other thing I need to mention is a lot of people have an arcade heritage. For me, what happened was when that Atari came out, I was like, you know, this is where I want to be. I want to be at home playing my games at
like
home.
Like, you'd rather sit at home and play an Atari than go.
I just like the fact that you could take your time, you were comfortable, you could sit down. I mean, the arcade experience was still an amazing thing. And, like, my parents, you know, they would go on a trip to Lake Tahoe, and I would go with them. And they had these little areas where they could actually bring you to this area. And it had, like, a chain link fence, and it was kind of, like, outdoors. And they had, like, ping pong tables. And then they had, like, arcade machines lined up. And I remember a famous episode where my mom and dad took me there, and I was just crying. And I was, like, holding on to the chain link fence, crying, telling them, please don't leave me here. Please don't leave me here. After a little while, I warmed up and started playing ping pong and then started playing some of the arcade machines and pinball and stuff like that. But I mean, I definitely spent a little bit of time in the arcades, but really when like that Atari 2600 hit, when home gaming hit and you could just play in the comfort of your home, I was more of a home gamer. But basically, yeah, you know, went through the 2600, oh, one thing I need to mention is when I started off gaming, I was kind of like your casual gamer, you know, and a kind of like a casual sports gamer, which...
Even on the Atari or...?
Well, on the Atari was like play whatever you can play, you know. I mean, yeah. I wasn't being picky at that point, but like when I got my Nintendo Entertainment System... And, you know, I was playing with friends and stuff. It was all kind of, you know, we would always play two-player, you know, Double Dribble or whatever, Tecmo Bowl, you know, Bases Loaded. And that's the, you know, those were the kind of games I played a lot. And it was later on where I kind of became just crazy hardcore and was into, like, every genre and was, like, getting all the magazines, you know, the second the magazines came out. I mean, I wouldn't even get a subscription to the magazine because I was so... Because I found out that the magazines came earlier at the newsstand. You know, they would get there, like, 5 days earlier.
Did you, like, know what date each month each magazine would hit the newsstand, or did you just go check every day?
I checked, like, almost every day. And, you know, that's going to be a good topic in the future about my little, you know, how I became, like, a hardcore game nut. But before that, I was more casual, kind of a sports gamer. But I played, like, you know, Ninja Gaiden, stuff like that. And I played Contra and stuff. I wasn't, like, just the guy that played Madden and Call of Duty and that's it. You know, I did venture off and play some of those other games. But I kind of was a casual gamer. And then at a certain age, right about 19 years old is when I made this switch, went hardcore. And from that point... You know, I was like this early adopter that was basically always buying systems, you know, right when they came out. Because I was 19, I was 20, you know, and I was an I was older, I was working, I had a job, I had steady income, and you know, that was my passion. My hobby was gaming. I got, you know, the magazines, and each month I would read them cover to cover. Even though I was like 20, 19 years old, you'd almost think, the magazines were kind of geared towards, you know, like a 13-year-old, but it was all that there was. You know, there was no internet. So, you know, that's how you found out about the latest game or the latest hardware that was coming out. So I was into all that. And, you know, system by system, you know, I always jumped on the bandwagon early. And another thing I must admit is I kind of jumped off the bandwagon early on all these systems, you know, because there would be a new system coming, you know, and I would get bored basically of the older system. And a number of times I can say that I probably jumped off a little too early. There's definitely a number of times where I jumped off the bandwagon right before something major hit. Like, for example, I got rid of my Nintendo Entertainment System like 2 weeks before Super Mario Brothers 3 came out.
Really?
And I had no idea that it was coming out.
Oh, all right.
And it wasn't until after I already sold it. But I wasn't really that hardcore into... I had no idea at the time how good that game was, you know?
Had you not seen the Fred Savage movie, The Wizard?
No, because at the time...
Because that would have made it clear that you needed to hang on to your NES.
Yeah, see, I was like 18 years old when The Wizard came out, and it was like, nah, that's not the movie you go to when you're 18.
Sure.
When I was 18, you know, I was going to RoboCop or whatever. I mean, no, that was earlier, but basically, I kind of would jump off the bandwagon a little bit early.
Because you always wanted to experience whatever was like the bleeding edge technology in games, you're saying.
Yeah, my number one focus was I was always craving, and to this day I still crave, I want to have the most immersive, you know, deep interactive experience. You know, I could basically, it's like, you know, when you watch a movie, a really cool movie, what's the ultimate? To actually be in a really cool movie and like be in that world. And, you know, it's going to take us a long time to get there, but I've always...
That's part of the point of gaming, though, you're saying, right?
Yeah, it's like...
To get lost in whatever you're playing.
Yeah, to get lost in the experience. And every time a new system would come out, it would be like, here's things that we're going to see that we never, ever saw before. And see, here, I was growing up in the era, you know, and then I was kind of a young adult in the era when, I mean, the leaps were huge. You know, each time the leap was a big leap. You know, nowadays, I mean, we just went from Xbox 360 to PlayStation 4, and a lot of people are complaining that, you know, they're not seeing this giant leap, and they're not, because it's the law of diminishing returns. But back when I was doing everything, the leaps were amazing.
Yeah, from Nintendo to Super Nintendo or whatever is a huge...
Absolutely.
Huge step forward.
Absolutely. And so anyway, that brings me to why I kind of thought about we should do a show like this. You know, because it was a magical moment every time a new machine came out, because it was the way I like to think of it. It's kind of like spring training for baseball, or like, you know, preseason for football. You know, every team in the league, you know, thinks that they have a chance.
Like, anything is possible.
Yeah, anything's possible. Everybody is, you know, everybody has zero wins and zero losses. And so you think, you know, hey, maybe this is our year. And
maybe the 3DO will be the greatest system of all time.
Yeah, you just don't know. And when that new system comes out, you know, there's always, of course, hype that comes along with it, because they got to sell the thing. But for me, it was like, you know, maybe I'll experience something with this system that'll really blow me away. And it was happening. I was having these, you know, every time I got one of these systems, there was something that blew me away. So, I mean, that's basically the idea for this show, is I kind of thought, you know, wouldn't it be cool if we took a look at the launches of various systems and tried to kind of look at them in a deep way? You know, maybe we don't even have like just a single episode. You know, there might even need to be multiple episodes. Like, you know, we could cover the launch. We could cover the launch window, and then we can kind of look at like what's the first, you know, the first year after it's settled in, or it's first Christmas or whatever.
I think it's an interesting topic, though, because I think people tend to forget a lot of the launch titles.
Exactly. And, you know, it was
nobody plays like PS2 launch games anymore.
Yeah. And You know, the thing is, it was about a year ago that I got the bug to play the Genesis for some reason. And, you know, because you bounce from system to system sometime, or, you know, sometimes you're playing modern games, you're not even playing retro for a while. But anyway, I got this, like, I got this thing where I wanted to play the Genesis. And I thought, you know, it'd be cool if I could go back to the beginning, like the very first games, and kind of see, because it's kind of cool to see, you know, the very beginning and the earliest games. And I was looking actually online, because I listen to podcasts when I'm at work, and I was looking for podcasts that were about the Genesis, because I was, you know, I was just into it. And I did, I found a couple Genesis podcasts, but, you know, they were talking about, you know, the whole entire life cycle of the Genesis, you know.
In one podcast, or?
Yeah, like they would have a podcast that was just like, let's look back at the Genesis. And,
you know, it seems like a lot to try to cover in one.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying the episodes were bad. It's just I was if somebody had an episode about like Genesis, the early days, you know, that's what I would have really wanted to listen to. And I didn't really see anything like that. And I remember thinking, you know, it'd be cool if somebody did a podcast where they took a look at this. But I just thought it would be cool if we kind of looked at the launches of various machines.
Absolutely. Which is what we're going to do now. So the Genesis was released in limited markets, New York and Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, yeah. There, it was basically a test launch.
On August 14th, 1989. Now, it was $189, and adjusted for inflation, that would be just over $350 now.
Yeah, which is, you know, which seems reasonable because, I mean,
it's not too far off of what a console, right? A PS4 now is $399, right?
Yeah, and so you got the Xbox One at $499, so you can, so I mean, at $350-something, I think the Wii, like, I mean, the Wii U, was it $349 when it first came out?
I believe so.
So, I mean, that's you know, right in the ballpark. But you know what? One thing that you have to take note is $189.99. Doesn't that price sound just a little bit weird to you? Like why not $199.99? It's $10 cheaper, and the Genesis was going head to head that August with another company. NEC, you know, had the PC Engine in Japan, and they brought it over to America as the TurboGrafx-16. But looking at this $189.99 price, that tells you right from the very beginning that Sega was in a dogfight, you know, from the very beginning when they were entering this market. I mean, they had the juggernaut of Nintendo. I mean, when we go back to like 1988 and 1989, Nintendo was like the 800-pound gorilla, you know.
It wasn't even really just a video game system. I mean, it was like a whole, I mean, if an inanimate object can have a cult of personality for like kids my age, like 12, 13 years old at the time, then Nintendo was it, right?
Yeah, I mean, but what I'm talking about is more like with retailers and stuff like that. I mean, they had like an iron grip, you know, with publishers. I mean, they could dictate, like, if you're going to bring, if you want to put that game on our system, you can't put it on anybody else's system. You know, that happened a lot, and that really hurt the TurboGrafx, you know, NEC. It also hurt Sega to a degree in the very beginning. There was a Batman game that got held back, if you remember. But the thing is, Sega, from the very beginning, was already in a dogfight. You know, they had to lower their price. Well, they didn't have to, but they decided to lower their price $10 to $189 to have this $10 advantage on the TurboGrafx, because the Turbo was coming in with a larger library of games, you know, and the Genesis didn't have quite as many games right from the beginning. So they wanted to give themselves a little bit of a differential, and they lowered it to $189. But it just goes to show you that Sega, you know, battling, I mean, going up against this juggernaut of Nintendo, which had like 95% of the market. And then also, you know, as they're going up against that juggernaut, you know, they have to go head to head with this other company. And, you know, Sega was a smaller company. You know, the NEC had, you know, much more financial backing.
Right. And because NEC is a computer company. Yeah. Also.
And, you know, Sega was a much smaller company, and they had to deal with NEC. They had to deal with Nintendo. It just, you know, goes to show that they were under the gun right from the very beginning.
Yeah. I also thought it was interesting to note that games then cost either $50 or $55, depending on the game, which, you know, 25 years ago, $50 was the equivalent of $95. And $55 would be $104.
Yeah, it's amazing when you think about...
Because people complain that, you know, the price of games went up from $50 a game to $60 a game sometime during the last generation of consoles. But really, they're way cheaper than they were.
Yeah, people complain all the time that games are too expensive, and I'll admit that I'm one of the people that does complain, because I think... See, here's the difference. Okay, now you can say that, you know, if we adjust it for inflation, these games were like $90, so why are we whining about paying $60? But back in those days, the entire population of gamers was like a smidgen compared to the population of gamers now. It is true that back in that time, we did pay a lot for those games. And
you I mean, know. Imagine how much, like, you know, when Strider came out, that was, I think, $79.99 because it had so much more memory in it.
Yeah, it was the first 8-bit
game. Or, like, Final Fantasy 3 on Super Nintendo, you know, that was another, like, $80. That one might have even been $90, which would have been, adjusted for inflation, like, well over $150.
Yeah, it was pretty crazy if you really think about that.
I also thought it was interesting to note that extra controllers for the Genesis were only $18. Because now a controller costs the same amount as a game.
Wow.
Now, mind you, a controller now is a lot more...
advanced.
Right. But it almost seemed like a no-brainer. Well, if a game is $50 and a controller is $18, like, why would you not grab an extra controller, you know, while you were grabbing your stuff? Because the Genesis did only come with one controller, unlike the Nintendo and unlike the Super Nintendo.
Yeah, yeah. And one thing that we do know about the launch is, like you said, it was August 14th. In New York and Los Angeles. And then, you know, it's funny because you'll read on message boards, you know, people will talk about, you know, what happened during the Genesis launch. And you know, different people will come in on the message board and they'll be like, well, I remember when it happened because it was my birthday and my mom brought me a cake. And that day she stopped at Toys R Us. And sometimes you get people that swear up and down like it was on such and such date or it was on this date and the date is wrong.
But you can't trust your memory as a kid.
Yeah,
necessarily.
Yeah, you really can't. And unfortunately, our memories do fail us. But on this one, it's pretty locked in that it was August 14th. But there is some confusion about, you know, when did the rest of the country get it? And I was doing a little bit of research on, like, Usenet, old Usenet posts, you know. And there was a guy on there, and he was calling every day, you know, all kinds of retailers around town, you know. And finally, in a future post, the guy said, well, it came today, and it was like September 13th.
13th, yeah, I wrote it
and,
down.
Yeah, and he got it at a Toys R Us in the Bay Area, and that's when it hit, you know, San Francisco. So I think nationwide it came about a month later. And, you know, the pack-in game, of course, was?
Altered Beast.
Altered Beast, yes. And they also had 5 individually available games. See, here's the thing about dates and Genesis and stuff. Okay, you know about Sonic Tuesday, right?
Yeah.
You know, that was a date that was locked in stone, right? But before that, it's kind of rare that you'd actually get an accurate date. In Japan, they have very accurate dates for when all the Japanese versions of these games came out for the Mega Drive. But here in the United States, you know, people will say, oh, this game came out this month or this game came out that month. But there is so much confusion about that. Like, just this, you know, the launch titles, the six games that were available on the first day. If you go to the average internet message board, you'll see all kinds of games mentioned.
Oh, I saw people were mentioning, oh, Alex Kidd was a launch game and Golden Axe was a launch game.
Yeah.
And Ghouls and Ghosts was a launch game.
And, you know, Alex Kidd and Golden Axe... We're talking 1990. Neither of those games arrived in 1989. A lot of games, like Revenge of Shinobi, people thought that was a launch. No. People thought the Arnold Palmer game, the soccer game. And but that's the thing. It's like, because a lot of these people back in that time, you know, they might have been 6-7 years old, and, you know, they have a certain memory in their head, but sometimes it's not always accurate.
Absolutely.
But we were able to find out the exact 6 games because there's actually a newspaper article that this one guy found and it talked with some kids at the time, like they got
the USA Today article.
Okay, USA Today.
Yeah.
And
that was backed up by that Usenet post that we saw where the guy bought the system and all 5 games and sort of gave a mini review of each one of them. And so though between that and the newspaper article, I think we can say definitively that those were for sure the 6 games that were available at launch.
Yeah, yeah, and it arrived nationwide right around September 15th, you know, mid-month or so. You know, so Sega, I mean, here they were coming into America. What did you, like, if you put yourself back in 1989?
Sure.
First of all, you know, how old were you? You know, what were you doing? The summer of 1989, what were you doing gaming-wise, if you were doing anything at all? And did you have any awareness whatsoever that there were new systems coming out, or did you know anything about it?
Well, I was 12, and that was the summer after sixth grade, so my last summer vacation before starting middle school. And my friends and I were definitely still deep into Nintendo, the NES. And I didn't read any gaming magazines or have any real exposure to like gaming journalism then. So yeah. If I had any awareness of the Genesis coming out, it would only be like if there were TV commercials before it came out. Or, I mean, my first memory of the Genesis was seeing
what about like
demo kiosk at Toys R Us.
Did you know, so you were in the sixth grade then, or just coming out of the sixth grade at this time.
Right.
Did kids at school, I mean, I'm sure they probably talked about Nintendo, but maybe they just didn't know that
no,
there was...
No, see, that was the thing, is we were still, like, totally enamored with Nintendo. You know, like, you weren't even thinking, like, oh, well, what else is coming out? Because, like, Nintendo was just this whole... It went beyond just a video game for, I think, for kids that age.
Yeah.
So you weren't even thinking, like, oh, well, what's this something else? Because Nintendo was, like, the cool thing to do, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, and myself personally, back in 1989 at that time... let's see, I was 18 years old, actually, at that time. And
was this like your first summer after graduating high school then?
Yeah, I had just, I was just about to move to San Diego. This was actually the summer I was living in Sacramento. I'm born and raised in Sacramento, by the way. But I was just about to move down to San Diego with some of my buddies were going to San Diego State. When I moved down there, you know, I took my Nintendo Entertainment System with me, and I had like Tech Mobile and... you know, Double Dribble and all that stuff. And I actually had no awareness whatsoever that there was anything, a new system coming out. I had no idea. I didn't hear about a TurboGrafx or a Genesis. I didn't watch a ton of TV, but I didn't notice any TV commercials. So I was completely oblivious. And I was a happy, you know, Nintendo gamer, but things changed pretty quickly for me after that. Because I did end up making a choice for one of these two 16-bit systems, but it didn't happen until December of 1989, and I ended up choosing a different system.
But oh, no.
That we'll save that for another podcast, but, you know, I wasn't really aware that there was a new system that was about to come out.
All right. Well, should we get started talking about the games then?
Let's do it.
All right. So the first game we're talking about, obviously, is the pack-in game, Altered Beast. So Altered Beast was actually a 1988 arcade release that was then ported over to the Genesis for launch. And it was designed by a guy named Makoto Uchida. Have you heard of him?
No, no.
So Makoto Uchida was also responsible for Golden Axe, Alien Storm, Manx TT Superbike, which is actually a game I really like on the Sega Saturn, and Die Hard Arcade on the Sega Saturn.
Well, you know, it. I mean, when you think of Golden Axe and... what was it? Alien Storm?
Alien Storm, yeah.
Very similar game engines to Altered Beast, you know, in terms of the type of game engine that it was running. So that does make sense.
Yeah. And what do you think of Altered Beast?
Well, Altered Beast...
I mean, it's like a much maligned game, I would say. Like, most, you know, people, like, it's like a joke game to most people. And in fact, the UK magazine Mega, have you heard of that magazine Mega?
Yeah.
They rated that as their number one worst Mega Drive game of all time.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, it's funny how certain games will get this kind of reputation later in life for being like a horrible, horrible game. But I didn't get a Genesis right away. But I did get a Genesis around August of 1990, about like 1 year after it originally arrived.
But Altered Beast was still the pack-in game.
Yeah, it was still the pack-in game. When I bought it, I actually bought it at a time where there was a coupon. This was through KB Toys. There was a coupon where if you bought a Genesis, you got one free game. And the game that I picked was Pat Riley Basketball. And the reason I picked that game was because it was the newest game that had just come out.
Yeah.
And I thought I might, like, sell it to somebody or something to get the game that I really wanted, because they didn't really have anything that I was super interested in.
Just out of curiosity, what was the game you really wanted?
I think I wanted Revenge of Shinobi, and they didn't. That KB Toys didn't happen to have it at the time.
Right.
And so I thought, well, I'll just get whatever the newest game that just came out is, because it's probably still going to be, you know, people still be interested in it because it's brand new. And but it did come, of course, with Altered Beast. And I played Altered Beast, you know, in that very early time frame. And I can tell you that, you know, Altered Beast is exactly what you want as a pack-in game. I mean, for the launch in 1989, you know, when you see Altered Beast running on the Genesis, if you put yourself into that time period, Altered Beast was a very impressive game. Graphics, like, really jumped out at you. I mean, the size of the characters, the parallax scrolling, you know, it was very impressive. You know, we've always hear people talk about, you know, ooh, this is arcade perfect. But this was a time when you saw a game. Okay, now it wasn't arcade perfect. I mean, let's be honest about that.
Although in some ways it was better than the arcade.
Yeah, it
although
had better in most control, ways,
it,
I think.
Yeah, it also had parallax scrolling of the backgrounds, which the arcade version did not.
Yeah, and the first level you actually have up to 4 layers, I think, of parallax scrolling, which was, and you know, speaking of first levels, the first level of Alter Beast, I mean, that is a classic level, because the rest of the game, I mean, that's the thing. If all you played was like the first level a bunch of times and that was your experience of Altered Beast, you probably thought the game was pretty cool, because when you got to the boss and that giant thing, you know, that giant guy came out of the ground and he was throwing his heads at you.
He was huge.
Yeah, gigantic. I mean, we had never seen sprites that huge.
All the sprites in the game were huge. I mean, your character was huge and the regular enemies were huge too.
What about when it first does the animation and you, you know, power up and then the guy...
Power up!
Yep, and the guy gets, you know, he gets a little bit more buffed and then you do it again and then boom, the transformation happens. When you first saw that cinema, that was like, oh, shit, this system's got some power, baby.
You know, it's interesting about that. In the current issue of Retro Gamer, there's actually an article about the making of Altered Beast. And this Uchida guy was interviewed in it. And he said, like, he took great pride in those little cinemas of you transforming into whatever beast you're transforming into. And he actually had, like, the Sega art department do it. It took them, like, a month. To make that, because for him it's like that was like the most impressive looking part of the game.
That was easily the most impressive part. And then also when you changed into different creatures, the cinema changed with it, you know.
Right.
It had the different, you know, forms that you changed into. And so, you know, Altered Beast gets a bad rap. And, it's one of those things where, okay, I never owned a Sega Master System, right? And so there's some Sega Master System games that I've tried, and I probably said, you know, that game's crap. But you know what? I wasn't there when that game came out. I didn't know what other games were coming out at the time. I didn't know what had come out before. You know, Altered Beast, one thing we need to say about Altered Beast, like you said, it was a more recent arcade translation. It was kind of like there was a little bit of excitement there about, you know, this is a recent translation. This isn't like a super old game. So I know you've played through Altered Beast. What do you because, you know, you came a little bit later to the Genesis, right?
Yeah.
And
I got my Genesis in May of 92 for my 15th birthday.
I mean, Altered Beast was obviously old news by that time.
Yeah, my system came packed with Sonic the Hedgehog, okay. The first Sonic the Hedgehog.
So the first time you ever tried Altered Beast probably was like way after its arrival.
Way after.
What did you think? I mean, did you think this is a piece of shit?
Yeah, so I didn't actually play Altered Beast until like 2003 or 2004 when I had a buddy in college we used to talk about retro gaming back then, and he was always telling me, like, you got to play Altered Beast, you got to play it, and his whole thing was the voice samples were so cool, especially...
Rise from your grave.
We used to just say that to each other at school all the time. We'd look at each other and just...
Yeah, the voice samples,
But so because of that, I went on eBay back then and bought the game just so I could check it out. And he came over and he's excited. Oh, we're going to play Altered Beast. And yeah, at the time I played it and I was, this game's crap.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I recently played through it, and I actually had never finished it, you know, when I was way back in the day. I mean, a lot of people say, oh, you could beat Altered Beast in like 35 minutes or whatever. I mean, they're
if
a half
good,
hour.
You could, easily.
But, you know, it takes a while to learn the different patterns. I mean, the first two bosses are pretty easy. When you get to level 3, gets a little bit trickier. But, I mean, it's, you know, it's just a matter of repetition. And also, I have to say that, you know, I never use continue, so I like to start over from the beginning.
Right.
But, you know, I think games should be judged. I mean, well, you can judge games two ways. I mean, I think they should be judged for the time that they came out. And then you could also take a look at them now and say, you know, is this game worth playing now? You know, is this game worth devoting some hours to now? And I'll admit that, you know, if you don't have any nostalgic feelings for Altered Beast, you can probably pass on the game. But people that actually played it at the time, that game was a killer app. It was your definition of a killer app because it was graphics and it was sound. The gameplay was very, you know, very standard and mediocre, and it was kind of monotonous. And it was a short game ultimately. But for somebody at that particular time frame that got that game, they were wowed by those graphics and sounds. And a short game, it's like when it's a launch, you know you're going to kind of get a short game usually.
And I mean, it was a free game, so
yeah, it was
packed
in. You
can't really complain too much.
Exactly.
But yeah, I mean, I like I said, I thought the game was crap, you know, when I played it back then. And I think just from all the conversations I have with you about stuff, it's kind of taught me to look at some old games like within their own time and appreciate them for what they were, you know, sort of for their historical significance.
Yeah.
And so I find now I can play Altered Beast, and I think it's actually pretty enjoyable because I put myself in the mindset of somebody playing it then. The thing is, because it was the pack-in game, the first pack-in game for the Genesis, and the Genesis was the first 16-bit system launched in the United States, somebody that bought a Genesis early on, no matter what they bought with the system, they were probably going to put that game in first because it's the pack-in game, right? Like, if you bought a Nintendo with Super Mario Brothers and then bought a bunch of other stuff back in the day, you're probably still going to play Super Mario Brothers first.
Yeah.
And so, like, Altered Beast, like, you're putting that in the system, you're turning it on, and that's going to be the first 16-bit experience you ever have. And that's your first impression, right? And the first impression is important. So this way, Sega was just saying, here, this is going to be your first impression of the 16-bit era. And you had the huge sprites and the parallax scrolling backgrounds and the digitized speech. And I think immediately you play that and you understood why you upgraded to the next generation of games. Because a lot of people think, well, first of all, it's a common misconception that Alex Kidd was a launch title, which it wasn't. But Alex Kidd was out in Japan already when the Genesis launched in the U.S.
Yeah.
So they could have localized it sooner. And I've actually heard people or read people online make the argument, well, that should have been the pack-in game because something to go up against Mario Brothers, you know?
Yeah.
But that's a perfect example. If that had been the pack-in game and you bought a Genesis and you put that cartridge into the system and turned it on, you'd have instant buyer's remorse. Because how is that much better than what you've already been playing on either Nintendo or Sega Master System?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think Altered Beast gets a bad rap. You know, is it ultimately, you know, a pretty shallow game? Yeah, but I mean, you know, you got to give something its due time, you know, the era that it was in and against its contemporaries. And I think, you know, of all these launch games, you know, Altered Beast is definitely one of the good ones, you know.
Absolutely. I agree. And just one last thing. I noted, I've never tried to play this game two-player, but apparently you can play two-player simultaneous. Did you?
Oh, yeah. Do you know absolutely. That?
So that's also awesome.
Yeah.
Genesis didn't come with two controllers, but if you bought a second controller, you could instantly go home and you weren't fighting with anybody over a controller. You guys were...
Yeah, and you'd be the two little wolf guys and you'd be throwing your punches. And
yeah. All right. So move on to the next one?
Yep.
All right, so the next game we're going to be talking about is
Super Thunderblade.
Now, Super Thunderblade was the follow-up to the 1987 game Thunderblade from the arcade. Now, Now, how would you describe the gameplay of Thunderblade? I mean, it's sort of a shooter, but it's like a pseudo three-dimensional shooter where you're sort of flying into the screen.
Yeah, I mean, Sega, you can tell with this launch that Sega was going to lean heavily on their arcade heritage. I mean, they have Alter Beast and, you know, Space Harrier 2 and Super Thunderblade, which, you know, obviously is a follow-up to Thunderblade. But it kind of does have, you know, it's like the scrolling 3D look. And like the arcade version, you know, the buildings, like when they're scrolling towards you, look yeah. pretty good. But when you see the Genesis version, I mean, obviously, you know, it's not quite to the level of, you know, the Sega System 16 arcade board. But, you know, I mean, it looks relatively impressive for somebody at that period of time. But I thought the control is kind of weak on that game. You know, you kind of go up and down and with your helicopter. And
I felt like that was the worst part of the game, was the movement, because it seems like it was trying to have, like, pseudo-realistic physics so that you didn't just immediately move to one side or the other. You sort of built up momentum and sort of swung from one side to the other.
Yeah, also it seemed like whenever I got hit by enemy fire, that it was like there wasn't like a real rhyme or reason while I was getting hit. It almost seemed like I didn't have a legitimate ability to try to dodge the fire. It just seemed kind of random in terms of that. You know, this is probably one of the weaker launch titles. I mean, I think it's pretty safe to say. There's only like four stages to the game, and it has, you know, it goes to that overhead style view when you're fighting the boss level. But
I feel like the overhead sections are even worse.
Yeah,
because you can't move your helicopter front and back. You only go from side to side, so you have like this little short window of time to shoot anything, because you can't move around the screen like you would if it was just a normal, like, spaceship-style shooter.
Yeah, I know. It's a bit ridiculous because, I mean, they go to they switch to this overhead style, and if it was, like, your typical vertical overhead shooter, you know, it could have been fine. I don't understand why they did that, but, you know, I guess it just gave a little switch to the game. But definitely, I think Super Thunderblade is one of those games where if you were there at launch and you got this game, it's one of those games where, you know, the scrolling probably seemed kind of cool. It probably seemed kind of arcade-ish, like, ooh, you know. I mean, it probably seemed something like the Nintendo Entertainment System wouldn't have been able to quite do that. But, you know, overall, I think it's like one of those pretty shallow launch games that is very forgettable. And it's like, you know, I think Alter Beast is one of those games where it'll always kind of get remembered because of the pack-in and all that. Super Thunderblade is one of those games where it would be lost to time as far as, like, people remembering it having any significance whatsoever to the Genesis.
Yeah, I felt pretty strongly that it was the worst of the games that we're going to talk about today. Only because I think the game is very similar in style to Space Harrier 2, but I think that Space Harrier 2 is the better game, so...
Yeah.
I don't see why. I feel like Super Thunderblade is like, well, I went and bought my Genesis, and it was the only game they still had in stock, so I went ahead and grabbed it. But
yeah, and if you're looking for that 3D graphic experience, I think Space Harrier 2 is a much better game, because I think the 3D, when it scrolls to you, I think is a little smoother, and I think the control of your character is smoother in comparison to the control of the helicopter. You know, it's a similar type of thing. You know, you're controlling this thing that's floating around and you're fighting things that are scaling at you. So it's kind of similar. But yeah, I think everything just flows a little better on Space Harrier 2. And I think they actually had a better developer. So that's probably a big reason why. But, you know, one cool thing about Super Thunderblade is, you know, when I was playing it was early in the first level, you kind of face this mini boss, this like tank thing. And it, you know, slowly scrolls out and you're trying to avoid its fire and shoot it and stuff. And at a certain point, it starts shooting like these yellow torpedo things at you. And it's just a really cool sound effect.
All right, so the next game we're going to talk about is the only sports game that was part of the launch.
Tommy Lasorda Baseball. This one is a real interesting one because a lot of people are probably totally unaware of the fact that Tommy Lasorda is actually a port of, well, you know, it's Super League for the Mega Drive is basically what Tommy Lasorda is. But you have to back up and understand that there is a game called Power League for the PC Engine. And this is a famous baseball series that was on the PC Engine. And when
I love those games.
Yeah, when it came to America with the TurboGrafx-16, the first Power League was translated as World Class Baseball. And so Tommy Lasorda is actually going head to head with World Class Baseball. I'm pretty sure both of these games were out in the month of August, although we'll have to double check when we get to the TurboGrafx launch. But they're basically the same game. Now, the thing is, people will say, well, no, they don't really look the same. And they don't, because Sega decided to spend the money and get the Tommy Lasorda license, where NEC decided, nah, we're not going to try to make it like a real baseball game. We're going to call it World Class Baseball, and we're going to give it, instead of these Japanese league teams, we're going to say it's the Chicago Wind or, you know, the Frankfurt whatever. You know, so they made these world teams, and then, you know, Sega did spend some money on Tommy Lasorda, so they
said... That's the only thing they spent licensing money, though, on, was Tommy Lasorda himself.
Yeah, but they did spend the time to actually make the teams this, like, you know, there's a Los Angeles team.
Yeah, it's like
there's
the same city and the same color scheme.
Yeah, and you know, with the TurboGrafx, you know, you don't get that with World Class Baseball. There's no connection whatsoever to real baseball with World Class Baseball as far as, like, Major League. So I actually remember, I have some memories of Tommy Lasorda, because although I did not have a Genesis when it launched, around the launch, there was a guy that lived in the apartment complex that we lived in, a friend of ours, who did have the Sega Genesis, and he sometimes brought it over to our house. And, you know, but people would, you know, you'd play with Los Angeles, and it had, you know, the team had, like, blue uniforms, and, you know, so it there was a little tiny bit of a connection to, like, real Major League Baseball, where there isn't that with the World Class Baseball. So it does have a little advantage there. Yeah.
Do you think it was a big deal back then to have, because there's other games that are like that where they had no official, like, MLB or MLBPA license or their analogs on other leagues.
But they just
like you said, it's like, you know, the San Francisco Giants, it's an orange SF with a black background. Like, you know it's the Giants, even though it doesn't say it.
Yeah, and sometimes...
And to me, that was always good enough.
Yeah, so, and sometimes what they would do with those games is they would have different named players, but the stats would be very similar. You know, and like, you'd have a third baseman that hit 35 home runs, and it just so happened that the real team had a third baseman that hit 35 home runs. You know, I don't know that Sega did that with this game, and I don't think they did, but it still was a little bit of an advantage. But here's the thing. Okay, Tommy Lasorda on the Genesis, if you look at the sprites of the game compared to the World Class Baseball and the TurboGrafx, they went with a more realistic, you know, human-looking sprite, a little bit more advanced. The problem is, when they switch to this type of sprite, the characters are very stiff. And if you play World Class Baseball on the TurboGrafx, the characters move a much, much smoother. They have a much more cartoony appearance. Another difference is... the field, like on the Genesis, you'll notice, you know, they have the mowing rows and, you know, mowed one way and then mowed the opposite way for that baseball look on certain baseball fields. And World Class Baseball doesn't have that. The other thing is, Tommy Lasorda did have a big advantage with voice samples. The TurboGrafx game also had voice samples, but the voice samples on Tommy Lasorda were much cleaner.
Right.
And so that was an advantage, because, like, when you heard Strike on the TurboGrafx World Class Baseball, it didn't really sound like Strike. So the voice effects were better. And then also, when, like, the ball hit the bat on Tommy Lasorda, it had this crack that really had a good ring to it.
Left fielder.
See, I feel like those sound effects, going back to, like, what I said about Altered Beast being such a step forward from 8-bit, I would say the same thing here if you played Tommy Lasorda when all you'd been playing before was Baseball Stars or RBI Baseball on the Nintendo. Like, just those sound effects alone sound amazing compared to what you would have been used to.
Well, yeah, you know, when I first saw Tommy Lasorda, when that guy brought over his Genesis to show off his, you know, shiny new toy, one of the most impressive, I mean, you know what blew me away? It was like one of those, oh, shit moments. It's like when the ball goes up and it gets bigger and bigger and bigger.
Yeah, like it scales.
Yeah. That was like really impressive effect. And they have that in World Class Baseball, but it's not quite as pronounced as it is in Lasorda. Another thing that has to be said for the whole entire Power League series, good music. I mean, even the Genesis version has good music, although I will say it's a little bit scratchier than the TurboGrafx World Class Baseball. I think it's a cleaner, crisper stereo sound, but still, it has a good, catchy, you know, music to it, although it, I'm pretty sure it repeats over and over pretty
But still bad. a huge step forward again over anything that was on an 8-bit system.
Yeah, it was definitely a jump up. Ultimately, I would have to say, though, like in terms of like this head-to-head comparison, because it was a head-to-head battle between World Class Baseball and Tommy Lasorda, although I think most people have heard of Tommy Lasorda Baseball and probably not that many people have heard of World Class Baseball. But if I were to really compare those two games head-to-head, I would actually choose the TurboGrafx version every day. Because it just had a better flow. It was smoother. The controls were better. I think the music was cleaner. You know, the Genesis game did have the city names, and it did have the voice samples, and it did have a few sound effects that were pretty awesome, but the control was a bit sluggish. Now, if you only own the Genesis and you never played World Class Baseball on TurboGrafx, you'd have no idea, and you'd be perfectly happy. And believe me, this guy that came over was perfectly happy with Tommy Lasorda. He loved that game. And it's still a good game in its own right, but I
definitely enjoyed playing it, getting ready for the show, yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, if you want to go back and try one of the early Power League games, I would probably recommend Power League 3 on the PC Engine, which I think is outstanding. But World Class Baseball, anybody out there that has a TurboGrafx, you can get World Class Baseball for probably like $4 or $5.
Yeah, it's one of the cheapest TurboGrafx.
You know, nobody cares about it because it's like sports game. Who wants to play a sports game? But let me tell you, this is like an arcade-type baseball game. This is not a simulation. It has an arcadey style. It has great sound. And, you know, I highly recommend World Class Baseball. I think it gets short shrift.
Okay. I mean, I agree with everything you said, and I just would say I think Tommy Lasorda Baseball was definitely one of the better launch games, definitely a good launch game that I could have bought and felt happy with my purchase. It's hard for me to kind of rank them with the other games.
Yeah.
Just because how do you compare a sports game to a bunch of arcade games? But I would just say I think it was a quality title.
Absolutely. And, you know, if you're going to launch a new system, you want to have one sports game, you know. So I think it was definitely good for them to have a good sport. And, you know, Tommy Lasorda, I'm sure it sold pretty well, you know.
Yeah, I remember him being very popular.
Yeah, there were some commercials.
They won the 88 World Series, if I'm not mistaken.
And, you know, the whole Kirk Gibson and all that. Yeah.
Oh, I watched that, yeah.
But there were some TV commercials that they had in that deal with Tommy Lasorda, and they had him, like, talking about the game and stuff.
Baseball is my life. Gotta start Oz. Hot hitter.
Game time, Tommy.
I'm on my way. Hit away.
Base is loaded, Tommy. What do we do?
Bunt. Shift over. Dead full hitter. Double play. What a game.
Game's over, Tommy.
Ain't over till it's over. Genesis by Sega. It's a whole new ballgame.
So, I mean, they probably got their money's worth with that license, and it probably really worked well for them for the launch.
All right, next game up is Space Harrier 2. Now, Space Harrier 2 is a 3D rail shooter similar to Super Thunder Blade, and it was designed by a man named Yu Suzuki. Have you heard of him?
Absolutely. And I think this is, was it AM2 that was actually did
yes,
this game?
Yes, he was with AM2, yes.
Okay.
Just to rattle off real quickly, just sort of a list of highlights of games that Yu Suzuki has worked on. They include Hang On, Outrun, Afterburner, Virtua Racing, Virtua Fighter, Daytona USA, Virtua Cop, and Shenmue.
Yeah, that's quite a list.
Yes, he's actually been referred to as the Shigeru Miyamoto of Sega, which doesn't seem like it's a misplaced compliment at all.
No, I mean, you look at that, I mean, he's been behind some amazing games.
So as we talked about in the Super Thunderblade segment, I felt like Space Harrier 2, they are similar games, but I feel like Space Harrier 2 is the better of the two games because I think it controls better because it doesn't try to have realistic physics and it just, you zip your dude around the screen with the D-pad without having to feel like you're fighting with it. And I also think it has better graphics. They're certainly more colorful, and I think that the scrolling is more smooth.
Yeah, that's pretty much... It's funny because when we were preparing for this podcast, you know, I obviously wanted to play all these games a little bit, remind myself about them. And when I was playing Space Harrier 2, at first I was thinking, this is pretty crappy. But it was because I was just kind of going off the, you know, just a quick impression, and I wasn't... But once I learned like how to move my man the right way and kind of zig him and zag him, there's actually a lot of fine control in this game of moving your character around once you learn how to do it. And also, you know, when the shots are coming at you, like when that dragon guy is, you know, shooting those round beams at you, you know, they come in a certain pattern. But when you get the feel for it and you know how to dodge it, everything makes sense. And I actually think that this is a pretty decent translation, you know, all things considered. You know, this is another game for Sega where it shows off, you know, that arcade heritage. And that's basically, you know, when they brought this Genesis out and they had these games, it was like, you know, blam, Alter Beasts. You know, here's a serious arcade port. You know, Space Harrier 2, a legit, you know, arcade port, and then Super Thunderblade, maybe not as great, but another, you know, arcade game. And, you know, they kind of were showing, you know, we have this expertise in arcade games and we're going to bring these arcade hits to the home.
Yeah. I felt playing the game based on the reasoning that I used for Altered Beast. I also felt that Space Harrier 2 would have been a decent pack-in game for the same reasons, because I really felt like it showed off the system. Just because that 3D scrolling is so smooth and it is so colorful. And it's got, like, the digitized speech. Some of it's scratchy, like when your character dies. But then when, you know, you start your next life.
Get ready!
That's quite clear.
Yeah, but, you know, I will say those are probably the most two irritating sound effects I've ever heard.
You don't want to get ready?
No, when you play the game, for some reason, they have both of those sound effects, like, 20 times higher than they should be compared to the rest of the game. I mean, because I had, you know, I was playing it and I have my Genesis hooked up to an actual stereo, you know, and I kind of crank it up a little bit to really hear the music. And it damn near gave me a heart attack when I first heard the.
Yeah, it's pretty loud. Yeah, and the echo doesn't help that.
And the get ready either. Is even louder, I think.
Yeah, you don't like get ready?
Get ready?
That makes me want to get ready.
Yeah, you know, I mean, Space Harrier 2 is a pretty cool game, but... I mean, for somebody that was there at launch, I could see them getting Space Harrier 2 and, like, really being impressed with its how close it is to the arcade, and it was probably a pretty decent game. But, I think when you look back on these six launch games, you know, Space Harrier 2, not one of the best of the six. Not unbelievably horrible, but not one of the best.
So the next game we're going to talk about is Last Battle. I'll just start this off by saying that if it weren't for Super Thunderblade, I would think that this is the worst launch game.
It's definitely in a close battle with Super Thunderblade. I don't think there's any question about it. Despite the fact that music that we just heard that plays in the first level has kind of got a nice little jingle to it. But, you know, when you first see Last Battle and you see these large, gigantic sprites on the screen. And it's like this, you know, side-scrolling action-adventure type game. At first, you think, you know, this might be a real prime-time game, you know, for this launch. And I'm sure, you know, you got to imagine that there's a lot of unfortunate kids out there that, you know, when they got the Genesis and they were looking at, you know, what games were available, you know, you see the cover of Last Battle and you look at the screenshots, and I'm sure there was probably a lot of kids that were like, ooh, I want this one. This one looks the coolest.
I think, well, one of the main problems I have with Last Battle is that it's just too similar to Altered Beast. But similar in a way that it's not as good. Like, it's a pretender, I think, to Altered Beast. The only thing I think that Last Battle has going for it is that there are more stages, and it does have a plot, however bad it is, and that you can sort of choose your path. You know, you have like that, I don't know if you call it an overworld map, sort of something like Super Mario Brothers 3, where after you end the first stage, you can kind of decide which way you want to go.
Yeah, that's probably the coolest thing that it does have going for itself, is that you can choose an alternate path. Eventually you'll wrap around and have to eventually hit these like bosses that you face. That's probably the coolest thing about it. I mean, you know, when you first play that first level and your character is jumping around and doing his little kicks and everything, it doesn't take you very long at all to realize that the control is pretty weak.
Very stiff, I would say.
Yeah, you don't feel like you have very good control of your guy. Like, when you're doing your little kicks and stuff, you feel kind of, you don't have a confidence at all. You feel like, maybe I'll kill this guy, but I don't really feel confident about the way my guy's moving around on the screen.
I would note, you only get one life, and you have no continues, which I thought was kind of brutal, because I think I was playing the game earlier today, and I think you have to kind of learn which path to take on that map, because right after the first stage, you can fight a boss battle in the second stage, and that boss is kind of a pushover, but if you go a different way, I ended up going, you know, sort of down instead of right, and fighting a different boss who just kicked my ass, and like, that's it, game over. Like, you don't fight the boss again, you don't go back a stage, it's just you go back to the title screen.
Yeah, that part of that could be that I'll admit that I, you know, didn't get very far at all. I had problems every time I was fighting the bosses. I just, you know, some of these games, you know, you go back and you revisit them, and they're just not that great to revisit. So, you know, you don't want to spend that much time with it. But ultimately, I just think that Last Battle is probably one of the worst of these launch games. And again, like I was saying, I think, you know, it probably looked like a cool game to somebody that had no clue. And
well, I fell victim to that a lot of times as a kid. Yeah. I went by screenshots and box art, and that's no way to buy games. I also mentioned that in the same article that rated Altered Beast as the number one worst Mega Drive game of all time, Last Battle was number two. So... yeah, I think they just don't like that style of game, so I think we'll just leave it at that. All right, so the last game we're talking about today is the amazingly awesome Thunder Force 2. Now, I love this game, Anthony. What'd you think of it?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I think it's the crown jewel of the launch, you know. It's very hard, though. It's not the easiest game in the world. The first thing that I noticed, this was like almost a year ago. Remember when I was telling you that, you know, it was like a year ago I got the bug to play the Genesis, and I decided to start playing the early games?
You know, it was because you told me about that, and because of that, I picked up Thunder Force 2. When I was at like a gaming convention.
Okay. And I remember when I played it, you know, because I was just like, well, I'm going to play all the earliest games. And so, you know, I popped in Thunder Force 2. And right off the bat, I was shocked by the fact that, you know, I could basically go left, I could go right, I could go up, I could go down, and the game scrolled in every direction.
It's like a sandbox shooter.
Yeah, and it has like a seamless scroll to it. It doesn't feel that horrible in terms of like scrolling. And man, I got lost in that first level. I can't tell you how many times I was flying around that first level trying to figure out, you know, what the heck do I got to do? I mean, I knew that you had to destroy those bases, But
I don't feel like I have the game with the manual and everything, and I don't feel like the manual was particularly helpful in helping me to figure out what to do in that first level.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, just for those that don't know, I mean, like Anthony said, it's like a 360-degree, I guess, free-roaming shooter, and there's these ground bases that you have to blow up. But, like, you're trapped in a certain area, and then you have to blow up the base in that area and then figure out how to, like, open sort of this electric fence kind of thing to get into the next area. And you have to do that, I think, three or four. I can't remember if it's three bases or four that you have to blow up.
I'm pretty sure it's at least four.
Yeah, and then once you blow up that last base, then the level just comes to an end without, like, any kind of boss battle or anything. But, I mean, when you sit down and play that game for the first time, you kind of don't know what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, you're kind of just roaming around. And also, when you are roaming around, the enemies, the ships, and the other little enemies that come after you, you kind of have to play in a certain way where you got to, like, pull your man back, shoot, pull your man back, shoot, and then like move him around. Because,
yeah, you play very defensively, definitely.
Yeah, you really have to be super defensive in this game, at least in the overhead levels especially. But yeah, I mean, I was stuck in, I mean, I played this game numerous times since, you know, rediscovering it. And, you know, I could spend a pretty long time in the first level because I still don't really fully know exactly how you're supposed to get to the second level. I just eventually do. And then,
I mean, it's just memorization. You just have to memorize the sequence and everything.
And when you get to the second level and then it goes side scrolling,
yeah, it's a horizontally scrolling shooter. Yeah. I mean, just for those that haven't played it, that's just how the game is formatted. It's like the first level is the overhead deal. Second level is horizontally scrolling shooter. Then the third level, it goes back to the overhead. And then so it just oscillates back and forth between those two game modes.
Yeah, it's, you know, if there's anything bad to say about Thunder Force 2 is that the difficulty might be a bit much.
I mean, I think it's a difficult game, but I think out of all the launch titles, I think the reason I think it's a good game is I think it's very compelling. I can sit down and I can play that game for a long time, and because I'll play it and it'll work me and I'll get game overed and I'll just want to play it again. I'll start over again and play it again. Like, I don't get frustrated. Like, I understand, like, yeah, I died, but it's because, you know, I messed up or whatever. You know, I mean, it's a hard game because especially in the overhead levels, you've got enemies flying at you, shooting at you, and you've got stuff on the ground shooting at you too, and sometimes it's just you can't get away and you get killed. But I never feel like the game is unfair, even though it is very challenging, and so I just want to keep playing it and playing it.
Yeah, this is another Genesis game where there's a lot of voice samples in the game. Like, every time you get a different weapon, you know, there's a lady saying, like, your weapon voice. And there's also a really weird voice sample when the game starts.
What do you think he's saying there? I can make out good luck, and that's it.
Yeah, something, 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 good luck.
I mean, I got nothing.
Yeah,
it's awfully scratchy.
You know, you'd probably have to send that tape to, like, those people that study, like, ghost voices or something for them to try to figure out what the heck's being said.
I was actually thinking, I never did it, but I was thinking about getting my iPhone and turning on Siri and holding it up to the speaker and see what she could come up with. Yeah. I never did it. I'm sure it would be nothing.
You know what's funny about that is there's a website called Sega 16, a really cool website dedicated to everything Sega. And on the forums there was actually a forum thread about trying to figure out what the heck they're saying in this game at the beginning.
You know? I maintain that it's not English, except for the good luck. I don't know. I just think I think it's probably some Japanese. And I think then good luck. That's my opinion. That's an uneducated opinion. I haven't read the thread on Sega 16.
It's just kind of funny that people remember that from this game. But, you know, I mean, the voice samples, you know, every time you got a new weapon and you heard the various voice samples, it was just, you know, it's another thing kind of reinforcing to you that, you know, you are now playing with 16-bit.
Absolutely.
You know? And, you know, you're bumping up a level. And I can tell you, man, Thunder Force 2, the music in that game, if you had a Genesis in 1989, and you know how the early Genesis has the little headphone jack on the front.
Absolutely.
And if you know, have a little adapter that plugs into that, and then you're going to a stereo, and if you're pumping the sound of Thunder Force 2, I mean, it's an impressive sounding game.
Do you think it might be possible that some people might have given that game short shrift during the launch because it was just a shooter and, like, well, I can play shooters on an 8-bit system? Like, if you just went by just the screenshots on the back, you might not think that, oh, this is the game that I want, you know, to get that full 16-bit experience. And they might have ended up like unknowingly screwing themselves over from what was easily the best game of the launch.
Yeah, I mean, most people didn't really know what Thunder Force was. You know, there was a previous game, but, you know, in the United States, people didn't really know about it. The Thunder Force series became a big deal, and it started with this game and continued with a couple more games on the Genesis, and then I believe there's a Sega Saturn version, yeah, as well. And, you know, this to me is like the first gamer's game on this system. You know, that, like, if you're a real prime time gamer, you know, I mean, if you're a hardcore gamer, you're going to get a Genesis, you're going to get your hands on Altered Beast, you're going to get your hands on Space Harrier and probably Thunder Force 2. And, you know, Space Harrier and Altered Beast, you're probably going to finish those games pretty quickly, you know, once you figure out the patterns and stuff. But with Thunder Force 2, you're going to really have to work to get through.
Yeah,
this
you're going
to
sink your teeth into that one.
Yeah, this one's going to be the one that, like, this is going to be your go-to game for the launch, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I don't have anything else to say about it except that I think it's awesome. I mean, even not just judging it compared to other launch games, but I think it's one of the best games, one of my favorite games, I should say, to play on the Genesis.
Yeah, I don't know I'd go that far. I mean, there's a lot of good shit. I mean, the only reason I wouldn't go that far is the difficulty.
Well, just to me, though, that's the point of a shooter. Like, I don't want to play a shooter that's not difficult.
Yeah, but I mean, there's another shooter on the Genesis, you know,
Gyres or something.
Yeah, and that one is difficult as well, but I think that shooter is quite a bit better than this one.
I'm not trying to make the claim that Thunder Force 2 is the greatest shooter on the Genesis, but...
Yeah, but I don't even know if it's in the top five.
I think it sets a good tone for shooters on the Genesis, though, you know? Like, well, if you were a shooter fan, you bought a Genesis and got Thunder Force 2... I think you'd be thinking to yourself, man, like, hopefully this bodes well for shooters on the Genesis, you know, because right out of the gate, the first shooter was, in my opinion, at least a very good one.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's no question this is easily probably, I mean, this, you'd have to consider this the best game of launch. And, you know, I mean, Altered Beast is a cool game as well to a degree. And, you know, Tommy Lasorda is pretty decent. Space Harrier 2 isn't too bad. But, you know, Thunder Force 2, easily the best game of the launch. And even if you were to open it up and look at, like, all the rest of the games that came out in 1989, Thunder Force 2 would still be one of the absolute cream of the crop games, you know, for the first year of the Genesis. As you start to get into the later years, you know, obviously developers have more time with the machine and they can make, you know, some more things happen. But absolutely, Thunder Force 2 is the star of the launch, in my opinion.
I should also say that Thunder Force 2 was the lone game of the launch that was $55 instead of $50.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. So that's the system and the six launch games that came out in August of 1989. Anthony, what did you think of that launch? Just as a person who's experienced buying systems at launch, where would you place this one?
You know, I think it's a quality launch. You know, I mean, you got six games, which isn't a ton of games, but, you know, we've had other systems that have only had maybe two or three games. And then we've also had systems that have had like 15, 16 games. But I think it's a pretty good launch. I mean, you got to consider the time that it came out. You know, you got a sports game, you got a shooter game, you got an action adventure type side scroller game with Altered Beast, kind of a beat 'em up. And I think you got a nice mix of games here. You got some arcade ports. Overall, I think it's a high quality launch, and I think Sega, you know, was able to start off in a good way, especially considering they were going head to head against another company, and also, you know, going up against the juggernaut that is Nintendo.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to ask you two questions related to each other. If you had bought a system on launch day, not knowing what you know now, just if you took yourself back to 1989 and you had enough money for the system and one game, which game do you think you would have bought? And the second question is, knowing what you know now, which game would you have purchased?
Well, I can tell you that the gamer that I was in 1989, I would have bought the system and I would have bought Tommy Lasorda. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I would have been very much like the guy that was in my apartment complex that did the exact same thing. I don't believe he bought any other Genesis games, at least not until there was like another sports game. He was very much like me at the time, kind of a casual gamer that liked, you know, playing his buddies in a sports game. And so I definitely would have bought Lasorda, and I would have had no idea that World Class Baseball is a little bit better, but I would have been happy with Lasorda. I would have been pleased, and I would have, played Altered Beast here and there as well. As far as knowing what I know now, there's no question, I would, Thunder Force 2 would be my game. I'd be playing Altered Beast, and I might actually would have picked up Space Harrier too, at some point, probably not right away. I definitely would stay far away from Last Battle and probably wouldn't mess with Super Thunderblade at all either.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely agree with you as far as, now, knowing what I know now, of course I would take. I mean, after all the gushing I just did about Thunder Force 2, obviously I'd buy that. I had really bad luck buying video games when I was a kid because I would just totally base it on the box art. And I can't say for sure what game I would have bought back then, but I'm afraid to say that I probably would have bought Super Thunder Blade or something, and then
Last Battle, baby.
Yeah, and then just come home and just been upset about it.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, as far as how I feel about the launch overall, I definitely think it was a good launch, and I think part of what makes it a good launch is sort of looking not just at the six games that came out, on day one, but if you look at sort of that launch window and maybe compare it to what's going on now. A lot of people are upset about the launch of the Xbox One and even the PlayStation 4 to a certain extent because they feel like, well, I bought this system on day one and there are no good games coming out. But, if you bought a Genesis on day one and were even lucky enough to realize that Thunder Force 2 is the best game to get, you didn't have to play Altered Beast and Thunder Force 2 for that long before you had Ghouls and Ghosts coming out, Revenge of Shinobi, and Golden Axe. And if you were into sports games, Arnold Palmer Golf, which I think is really good. And, the soccer game is probably not so good. But, I mean, there was a steady stream of good quality titles coming out right from the get-go. So you never had a chance to let the Genesis, sit in your TV console and collect dust while you went back and played Nintendo or Sega Master System or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, back then, games came out at a little bit of a slower pace. But every month, you had a game here or a game there that would come along, and you always had something to look forward to. And that's the thing about when you have an early system, these launch games, you go back and play them, and other than Thunder Force 2, they're not really like must plays, Alter Beast for the historical part of it, but still you get a glimpse of the power of the machine. And, and you have that hope of what's still yet to come. Because I guarantee you, if somebody brought home a brand new Genesis and they played Altered Beast, and then when they're done playing and they're eating dinner or something, they're thinking about it, they're probably thinking, if I'm getting Altered Beast, if I'm getting these kind of graphics and sounds, on the first day, imagine what I'm going to be playing 3-4 years from now.
Absolutely.
So that's basically the launch of the Sega Genesis. We are going to continue to take a look at the Sega Genesis in some future podcasts. We plan on having one that discusses more of the launch window games, basically everything that came after these first six games, starting with the seventh game, which is Ghouls and Ghosts, and continuing through with a bunch of other classic games. And we might have an additional show talking about 1990 Genesis games and maybe early 91 Genesis games, and kind of give you that early flavor of what was going on with the Sega Genesis before everybody knew. Once you get to Sonic and once you get to a little bit later in the Genesis lifespan, everybody knows what went on then. But we're going to try to focus in a little bit more on the early time period of the Genesis. So we'd definitely have plenty more to still talk about when it comes to the Genesis.
Yeah. And just before we go, just to give maybe a little bit of flavor to August of 1989 and what was going on at the time, the awesome adolescent show Saved by the Bell had its series premiere that month. It's all right, 'cause I'm saved by the bell. And certainly anybody my age was watching that every week, and then every day in the morning when it was on in syndication. And interesting notes in the news, August of 1989 was when the Menendez brothers shot their parents down in Beverly Hills, and that was also the time when Pete Rose agreed to the lifetime ban from baseball.
I wonder whatever happened to the Menendez brothers.
I'm pretty sure they're in prison.
Yeah, I wonder.
I don't know that for a fact, but I'm
sure they're in prison.
I'd put some money on that.
I don't know if I heard if, like, was any of them on death row or anything? I never heard about that.
Oh, I don't know. You know, in California, you know, it doesn't matter. You just spend the rest of your life on death row. Death row is where you go to die of natural causes.
Exactly.
And so before we go, or as we go, we're going to give the final word to the late Mr. John Candy in his seminal role as Uncle Buck.
You so much as scowl at my niece, and I'm coming looking for you. Take this quarter. Go downtown and have a rat gnaw that thing off your face.